AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey, Katie.
Our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
And our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
We remain in our quarantine bunkers. There remain no more movies in theaters, but we have a really good show. We are kicking off our Little Gold Men Essentials series with Sunset Boulevard, as per overwhelming vote from our Twitter followers. And that includes a special interview with Wayne Lawson, who Mike refers to as his mentor. He was a longtime editor at Vanity Fair and worked very closely with Gloria Swanson and has some pretty incredible old Hollywood stories to share. But first, we want to catch up a little bit on the news that's going on in the world. Everything in Hollywood is pretty much shut down, but there have been some expected delays on some upcoming award seasons. I think the most noteworthy is that the Tonys have been postponed indefinitely, given that Broadway is still shut down and it's really unclear when it can reopen. That was kind of the only decision they could have made. But Richard, as someone who sees a lot of theater, I imagine you're as bummed out about this as I am.
Well, yeah, because you had kind of dispatched me to see a lot of the big spring stuff. So I had gone and gotten all my press tickets. I was going to see about three shows a week for about a month, which was really exciting.
Wow.
And Company and How I Learned to Drive and all this stuff. And now it's all, we were going to do a Tony's episode on the podcast again.
yeah.
So, you know, a minor loss in the grand scheme of things. But yeah, it's scary. And, you know, I have friends who work in the theater world, and I kind of naively didn't realize, you know, because they work, you know, sort of more in like one particular kind of more corporate side of things, not a performer or anything. But and it's like, oh, they could all, I mean, that industry could just completely collapse in, you know, a month. Like it's really very tenuous in a way that like you forget how small the margins are on these things. And yeah, so that's a pretty distressing. I think that the kind of grim thing will be, you know, a couple shows like Caroline or Change, the revival at the Roundabout, are going to come back in the fall, are going to actually open in the fall because they, you know, they're at these subscription houses that have a built-in ticket buying, you know, audience. But I think a lot of the sort of more regularly produced commercial things, I think they're just not going to happen. And I think, you know, we're just getting all this kind of stuff wiped out, which is going to be a pretty weird blank spot on the sort of timeline of Broadway theater.
Yeah, there's already been the Martin McDonagh play Hangman is not going to open at all. I think there's been a couple of other shows that just announced that they're not coming back at all, which is really heartbreaking. But also, you imagine, like, how in the world do you make up for this giant absence when, as you say, the margins on Broadway can be so small?
Yeah, I don't know. We're never going to get to see Laurie Metcalf and Rupert Everett in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? That's another one that's not going to happen now. I doubt that the company that they got together, you know, they brought the British production over with Patti LuPone and had Katrina Lenk from Band's Visit was going to play Bobby, the lead. My hunch is that's not going to happen. I bet the Mary Louise Parker revival of How I Learned to Drive, it's not going to happen, you know. So it's a weird thing to think about. And I think it's also... shifting into like movies and TV, the theater stuff is an interesting kind of prophecy of what that's going to look like, is that we're just going to run out of things. You know, movies are moving. Ghostbusters moved to next year. Morbius, the Jared Leto movie, moved to next year. TV production has stopped. We still have plenty of TV kind of in the can, but that's going to run out. So I don't know. I think, you know, I think the tale of this is going to be long in a lot of ways, and this entertainment world is going to be one of them.
Yeah, we can talk about the Emmys as being the other thing that shifted, although a lot less dramatically. They are basically pushing the entire timeline by about 2 weeks, which feels necessary. Like, you know, the Emmys voting deadline was June 1st. So they kind of are changing that. They're changing the process through which you, you know, campaign for people. The Golden Globes have canceled some of their required schmoozing, which is tragic to realize because that's like the true heart of the Golden Globes. But honestly, when you think about Emmy voting beginning on July 2nd, like, will things be back to normal enough for that to even happen as normal?
Well, the Golden Globes thing that interests me is the eligibility change that they've made, right? Where they're saying that, you know, a film can premiere on streaming and be eligible for the Golden Globes if you can show, you know, a reasonable intention that you plan to put it in the theater, right? But it's still a breaking down of a door that, you know, the various awards bodies had been holding firmly shut. In terms of, you know, like the whole Netflix question of like, does a Netflix film have to premiere in a theater? So that's just, you know, that might be a one-off for this year, but it's an interesting erosion of something that we've been talking about for years on this podcast.
Yeah. You imagine the Oscars doing everything possible to avoid having to do that. And a lot of maybe like qualifying runs happening in November to run for 2 weeks just to say that you had a theatrical release. Although, I mean, it's hard to figure out with the prestige and all of the stuff, all of the adjusting that goes into having an Oscar campaign, how not having a theatrical release is going to affect all of that.
Yeah. I'm curious about what, you know, let's just say, you know, this is under control by, you know, midsummer. And, you know, of course there's the fear of a resurgence in the fall. So it's hard to plan for the future, but let's just say like things start to kind of resume like normal, in a couple months. And then you have, you know, big planned film festivals in the early, you know, late summer, Toronto and Telluride and Venice and all that. And then you have all these movies that didn't go to Cannes. I'm just curious, like, what that pile up will look like. Like, if people will just kind of get out of the way, figure 2020 a wash, or if there will be sort of an almost opportunist kind of seizing on the momentum of people wanting to get back to theaters, seeing movies, excited about, you know, business as usual. So I think it could be kind of an interesting pile up there in August and September, or it could just be very quiet while people just consider this whole year a wash.
Oh, it's so depressing to think about the Oscars just being like this blank space where there's just like not enough movies that came out or not enough movies that were able to get enough audience. It's going to be...
Yeah. Or conversely, you know, it could be just a real time of rallying, you know, of like really wanting to celebrate what we do have, what we have had, what, you know, people trying to feel like we're back to normal in some way. So I could see it as a real opportunity for that.
I would love to see some creativity. I imagine there's a lot of creativity happening in terms of how do you make a movie if you can't, you know, go anywhere. And then some creativity in terms of the distribution, which we're obviously seeing now already, people just saying, all right, we can't release this in a theater. Like, sorry, we don't want to undercut our theatrical friends, but this, and it would be nice if the Academy would sort of acknowledge that. And if nothing else, take a year off from some of the more extreme restrictions on that. But yeah, it also feels like a year where there may be an opportunity for something interesting to get rewarded because there won't be as much of the usual fare.
Edgar Wright just tweeted something interesting, I think, this morning where he was saying, I wonder how many filmmakers are going to take advantage or have already taken advantage of the quasi-deserted cities around. You know, you think about how many films were shot in Detroit over the last few years like a bunch of horror movies were shot in Detroit just to show like just
empty
Detroit.
Streets.
Yeah. And so like, you know, all these other cities are emptied out. I mean, like I've been seeing some footage that people are taking of San Francisco. There's this one viral video of San Francisco in lockdown of just two like mounted on horseback policemen riding through the empty streets of San Francisco that someone put the Westworld theme song over. But like it was just like it's like Edgar Wright was like, I wonder how many filmmakers are taking advantage of that. He's like, I bet a bunch, but also they're gonna get, you know, shamed for doing it at the same time. So I don't know, be interesting to see.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So for the first week of our Little Gold Men Essentials series, we put up a poll to our Twitter followers, and the overwhelming winner, like by this crazy margin that I definitely didn't expect, was Sunset Boulevard. I mean, maybe we should have expected it because it is one of those like stone cold Hollywood classics that when you think like movies about Hollywood, it's going to be in the top three. But everyone was really excited for us to watch it. I had seen it before. But watching it again, I was like, I definitely didn't know who Buster Keaton was when I first saw this, so that I wouldn't have known his cameo in that bridge scene. So it was basically as if I was seeing it for the first time. And guys, it's a really good movie. Did you know that?
I just learned it myself. No.
Was anyone else like watching it essentially for the first time?
I was watching the movie for the first time. I'd seen the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical with Glenn Close when she brought that back a couple years ago to New York. So live theater used to be a thing. You'd go to a big room with a bunch of other people. And, but yeah, so I was new to the movie, and it's just amazing watching it. And I think, Mike, you had said something like, we wouldn't have, you know, Catherine O'Hara's character, Moira Rose, on Schitt's Creek without this. You wouldn't have so many, like, big kind of, like, actress roles without this kind of, you know, Gloria Swanson turn as Norma Desmond. It's just so iconic, and seeing the kind of birth of that iconography is really fascinating.
Yeah, you think about how it comes well before whatever happened to Baby Jane, or oh god, what's No Wire Hangers? What's that movie called? Mommy Dearest. Like all of those like kind of camp classic performances, or even like Cher's entire career. Like you think about this being 1950, and about how the template for like you know drag queens, like so many things based on this. It was so early. It's such a huge touchstone for everything that came after.
It's funny. After we watched it, I then watched tried to watch Something Like It Hot, which is Billy Wilder, I think 1959 with Marilyn Monroe and Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. And somehow, Something Like It Hot has not aged as well, I feel like, as this. Like, and partly because it's a comedy and everyone's sort of shouting and trying to be funny. And also, the late 50s were not nearly as cool as, I think, the early 50s. It's such an interesting film because it's at that fulcrum. It really feels like the end of the 40s, the beginning of the 50s. You can sort of, watching it, you can actually see why the 50s seemed like they would be a good idea at the beginning of the 50s. Like when Bill Holden escapes to that party of young people, you're like, oh, these people are kind of cool. They're having a good time, you know, huddled around the punch bowl in cardigans or whatever. So I think it's late noir, right? I mean, the 40s were kind of a noir time, but it just is so beautifully, perfectly done. The writing of it is incredible. And then obviously Gloria Swanson just, you know, embodying, I think, on and off camera, everything that was both amazing and probably needed to go away about the silent era that she represents.
Yeah, it's interesting. I first watched this film in school, like as part of like a long film studies course. And we had already studied like Eric von Stroheim, and we had studied Buster Keaton. We had studied like all the things, and Gloria Swanson, and all the things that came before it. So I have never watched this without like sort of an academic eye on it. And I'm so curious to know what the experience is like for people, because I know a lot of our listeners like just love this movie because it's a great movie. It's so fun. You know what I mean? And it's, I think the thing that I had forgotten about it is how funny it is occasionally. It's like, you know, that Billy Wilder wit is there in a lot of Bill Holden's lines. But as a relic or as a document of Hollywood, and Hollywood first, like, is this the first instance of Hollywood really turning its knives on itself in such a meaningful way? Probably not. But like, you know, the idea that like Hollywood is still so young when this movie is made, that the idea of fading stardom is still like such a newish concept, I think, or maybe that's naive. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting look at, you know, that the industry was just old enough to have relics, you know?
Right, exactly.
And I love that line toward the beginning where Holden is like talking about the mansion that she lives in. And he says, it's the kind that crazy movie people built in the crazy 20s. And so to think that, like, you know, Hollywood at that point had a 25-year or, you know, 20-year removed from that, and so had this kind of perspective on the industry that had been already. It's just like, it's just really interesting watching that sort of kind of almost like myth making start to happen around Hollywood and stardom and all that stuff. So I think you're right, Joanna, that like this is one of the early, or certainly one of the biggest early ones to be sort of meta and self-critical.
Yeah, you think about the fact that it came out 2 years before Singin' in the Rain, which is not nearly so cynical about the whole thing. Or I think 4 years before A Star is Born, the Judy Garland version, although, of course, there had been a 1930s version, which I think is a little bit cynical about the industry. But I think Billy Wilder was maybe in a position where he was like in the club enough that he could kind of poke his way into it. You know, he'd made Double Indemnity, I think, 6 years earlier, which is kind of one of the most like classic noirs that exist. And it's, you know, it's, there's affection in it too. Like, I think when you get the Cecil B. DeMille scenes and he is just, he's kind of this like warm paternal figure, and you see him just trying to be so kind to Norma Desmond, even though she's just impossible to deal with. But it's so unsparing at the same time. And the tone of it in the end is so grim for the, you know, the status of all of these living legends who the industry had completely moved on from. And we don't have, there's no really, really modern cognate, like silent stars being completely undone by the change of technology. You know, there's ways that stars can and can't adapt now, but that was such a monumental shift that ended so many careers.
I love when she just says, we didn't need words, we had faces. and almost half the time, at least, you know, she is doing that face, like, you know, neck arched back, eyes. I mean, her eyes are just absolutely incredible. But I love that scene where she goes to see Cecil B. DeMille and he is trying to be kind. And all of the, it's the crew, you know, it starts mm-hmm. with Hawkeye up in the rafters turning a light. Let's get a look at you. And then they all come around. I mean, it's incredibly moving. And the film, I feel like it is that classic sort of, the knives are out, but so is the heavy duty myth making machinery,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it really sort of, it's constantly, you're going back and forth between cynicism and really like, I don't know, a gooey center about what this
sympathy,
means.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I think that's it. That is kind of one of the ways that it has a sort of queer sensibility, which is like, you know, it, that campy thing is the making fun, but also the adoration at the same time, you know, and just to think about how much that's been aped since. I mean, the two things I kept thinking about watching specifically Swanson in the role was you would never have had Madeline Kahn's Bride of Frankenstein. like that's such a thing, but also you wouldn't have had Eddie Redmayne in The Danish Girl, I don't think.
Wow.
or Jupiter Ascending, and, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like it's such like a almost like starter kit of a certain kind of film performance that has continued for 70 years since. It's really remarkable.
The thing that I find fascinating looking back at its Oscar trajectory, you know, you watch it, you're like, wow, it only won 3 Oscars. Like, what the hell happened? It's because it came out the same year as All About Eve, which is crazy. Yeah. The fact that you've got this performance from Gloria Swanson going up against Bette Davis and Anne Baxter in All About Eve, and they both lost to Judy Holliday in Born Yesterday, a movie I've never seen. But it is this like fascinating year of dueling movies about show business, and also tells you why partly I'm fascinated by Oscar history is that, you know, a movie can be unjustly snubbed by the Academy, quote unquote, but it's all about the context of what it was up against. And that year it was up against another slam dunk masterpiece.
Yeah, it's tough. And like, it's interesting to me, you talk about that sympathy. What I really like is, or even Mike saying like this ages pretty well, like I was watching it sort of wincing the whole time at like, how mean is this movie going to be to this woman? And like, I really like the line at the end where Bill Holden's like, there's nothing wrong with being 50 as long as you don't act like you're 25. And I'm like, okay, the crime isn't aging. It's like all the other stuff that she's doing with it. Okay, that's all right. Then I'm on board with this.
So. Well, we have to talk about the ages too, because first of all, they're treating her like she's 175 years old.
Right.
She's like 5 years older than me, you know, which personally, I'm just like, man, okay.
Where's your mansion, Mike? You got to work on this.
Exactly. And then Bill Holden's 31. And then Nancy Olsen was 22. And they're all sort of playing their actual ages. Like, it's sort of, because of course I'm like IMDBing everybody going, all right, what is the age spread here? And they actually kind of cop to them all. It's not like they're not pretending she's 70, she's 50. But she is a relic from another age. She was in her prime when she was in her 20s. But it is sort of horrifying to think about how over the hill one could be considered at age 50, you know, 60, 70 years ago, versus at least now there are examples of people, you know, breaking that and not giving into it.
Many she's the same age as Jennifer Lopez is now.
Yeah.
Although Jennifer Lopez has had to, you know, she's worked harder than any human alive to age well. So maybe she's not a model for me, at least. I don't think I can accomplish it.
But it is, it's sad how it's like, it's just unthinkable for her to come back. Of course, the real Gloria Swanson does come back in the film. But it's like, it's everyone's just kind of like, oh, this sad, delusional dream that will never happen. And clearly, partly because she had turned into a huge diva and was a pain in the ass, but partly because it was just like, it's done. The book is closed.
Yeah.
And I think some of the extremity of that, I mean, the way that this is almost like a Dracula movie, like you know, that I think that the film is wryly aware of that. It knows, obviously, that, like, it's insane that a woman of 50 years old should be, like, kept up in a dark mansion and shunned by the world, you know? Like, the movie certainly knows that's ridiculous, while also acknowledging that at the time and for many years after was the reality as well. So I like that kind of, you know, self-aware kind of thing, because otherwise it would be, I think, a weird, you know, artifact of a different era. But it just feels so onto its own kind of wavelength that it feels sort of timeless, because it's so aware of what it is and when it is.
Well, and it has to do with, like, there's lots of other people who worked with her who are still working. That's why the scene works when she goes to Cecil B. DeMille's set, starting with Cecil B. DeMille. Right. But it is really specifically about stardom and the brutality of fame, right? Like, it giveth and taketh away. That's clearly, like, part of what this is all about. The fashion, you know, the viciousness of fashions coming and going. And then mix it with the technological change, which I feel like we can relate to the technological change side of it, even though that particular one is not relevant.
What a good shelter in place movie this is.
Yes.
Be like Nora Desmond. Dance on your floor that, you know, Tyron Power or whoever used to dance on.
Yeah, you can't hire that band, though.
The musicians must not know.
Eric von Stroheim is so good in this movie. And it's such an interesting, for this project, I dug out my old film history textbook, and I was reading up on Eric von Stroheim, and like the last big movie he did as a director was a Gloria Swanson movie, Queen Kelly. So like, that's, you know, they got her old director, you know. I mean, I knew he was a director. I just didn't know he was, like, Gloria Swanson's director, you
just
know?
To preview a little bit, we're going to call Wayne Lawson, my old boss at Vanity Fair, who edited and heavily was involved in the writing of Gloria Swanson's autobiography, Swanson on Swanson. And he has some good background on that relationship between Eric von Stroheim and Gloria Swanson that includes Joe Kennedy, the father of JFK and RFK, who had an affair with Gloria Swanson. But I will let, I'm just teasing it, but
a
we will
twist.
Call Wayne.
A political twist. Yeah, no, it's interesting. Like the Hollywood cameos could be cringy and often are cringy, but they're all perfect, I think, in this film. Like from Cecil B. DeMille to, I mean, von Stroheim's not cameoing, he's doing like a full role. Buster Keaton, etc. Hedda Hopper. I mean, like that Hedda Hopper was willing to like play herself as a monstrous part of this film is incredible. I don't know.
Honestly, I having seen, was it Hitchcock where Helen Mirren plays Hedda Hopper? No, Trumbo. I like didn't really know that much about what Hedda Hopper really talked like, or even like Tilda Swinton's role in Hail Caesar. I was like, oh, wow, they were really nailing it. Like, that is exactly what Hedda Hopper talked like.
I was watching a something about the kind of evolution of American accents and about how this that kind of mid-Atlantic quote-unquote thing was entirely made up by Hollywood. Like that no one in America spoke like that. And, you know, it's just so interesting. I don't know. I think that realizing where all of these kind of tropes came from is yet another reason to watch things, you know, made before 1975.
Well, yeah, the Katharine Hepburn, like Bryn Mawr accent, and then the, like the Cary Grant, like I think was born like lower class British and like comes over and does this whatever, you know, this thing that he does. And then all of a sudden, like people watching old movies are like, oh, we all used to talk this way. And it's like, no, just in Hollywood.
Well, like my husband, who doesn't really watch a lot of old movies, was kind of watching parts of this with me. And you see the scenes where Gloria Swanson and William Holden are talking to each other and they're doing two completely different eras of stylized Hollywood talking. And so that's where the movie really takes off for me is when they have their first conversation. You're like, they are talking from different planets, like they are on totally different planes of existence, and watching those two things exist in the same thing is completely thrilling. And I think if you don't know a lot about old movies, it's a really interesting place to start, being like, well, here was one version of it that she started, and then Hollywood had evolved by then. Like the history before 1980 is pretty complicated, it turns out.
I just love the semi-hacky but really funny and great narration that Bill Holden does from the dead. And you know from the beginning, this is like a screen, like a semi-failed screenwriter's version of his own death narrative. I mean, it really is. It's very bold and brilliant. And it just like, I just found myself just like laughing through the whole thing, but not with it, you know, just in kind of in awe, really, at so much of what they do, right down to the last scene of Gloria coming down that staircase, of Norma Desmond coming down that staircase. You just think this is like, it couldn't be better. It's pure genius.
That shot is this beautiful, weird, like almost theater art shot where the men are standing almost entirely still and she's walking down. It's really kind of presentational in a fascinating way.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I also think it's interesting the way that, you know, culture remembers things, that it's not, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. It's Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up, you know?
Right.
I just, and that's a small difference, but it's like
play it again, just, Sam.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the narration in Double Indemnity, I imagine we've all seen it, but it's similarly like gigantic and kind of funny, but then it totally sucks you in. And I think I've seen that the number one rule of screenwriting is never have a dead person be the narrator unless you're Sunset Boulevard. It's like the only time that trope has ever worked.
Right. I mean, it's Raymond Chandler probably should have had royalties on all of it. I guess he invented it, right? But it's just, it's such a fun style. Like the young people in it represent that, this kind of optimistic, chirpy group of people who, anyway, would make the 50s for better or worse.
Yeah, it's very post-war. I mean, you think about how someone like Norma Desmond could have disappeared because for 5 years there, everyone's head was turned in a completely different direction. And then she just kind of rotted away in her mansion, you know. And now everyone's kind of flooding back. The town is, you know, I mean, the town was operating throughout the war, obviously, too. But like, you know, it just has that feeling of newness, which nicely offsets, you know, her relative decrepitude.
I just found myself sitting there wondering what direction Billy Wilder was giving, and maybe Wayne will have some insight into this, but was giving Gloria Swanson, because she's like, you know, it's an incredibly sympathetic role and performance, but also self-parody to a degree, you know, so that like that moment where she takes the, you know, whatever beauty patches off her face, whatever they're doing, healing her wrinkles, I don't know. And she gives herself that look in the mirror right before she goes in to talk to him at the end. And I'm like, what did Billy Wilder say to her in terms of like what looks to be pulling here? And I, you know, to be a fly on that wall would have been amazing.
It feels like Gloria Swanson and Hedda Hopper were sort of in the same boat of being in on the joke enough to show up and do the movie, but also really invested in their image and confident that it's a great image and that people loved it. And that's why, you know, they had a special life, right? I feel like right. There's people like that in Hollywood now. We know those people.
Yes, we do.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
All right, so we are thrilled to be joined right now on the telephone, on the landline, by Wayne Lawson, my former boss and mentor and friend, current friend, the longtime executive literary editor of Vanity Fair, who knew Gloria Swanson very well. What would you say, Wayne, your contribution to her memoir, Swanson on Swanson, was? You edited it?
I virtually wrote the book.
Okay, good. I just wanted you to say it.
She was still married to her fifth husband, William Dufty, but falling quickly out of love with him, so that in the course of this producing this book, he lived at one end of their apartment, she lived at the other. There was a go-between who was a young English producer for the BBC, and he had done a show of Swanson's sculpture in London, and she had fallen in love with him. She was 80, he was 40. And at that point, she had said, what next? And he said, the memoirs. So he went out, sold a contract, got a contract from Random House without an agent, and they had a year to produce this book. She said to him originally, it won't work because Bill Dufty and I have tried this before, and we just couldn't make it work. And he said, don't worry, with me, you'll be able to. Well, after 6 months, they had 100 pages. And so Brian Degas, his name was, called me, and said, would you read this before we give it to Random House? And so I read it and said, you can't give this to Random House. You know, you can't start by saying I was born in 1899 under the sign of Aries. You know, it just sounds like an old lady's book. So he said, would you tell that to Gloria? So Gloria and I met. I said, look, I think this is the wrong way to go. I would do this as a flashback, you know, because I'm assuming that Sunset Boulevard is the greatest film you ever made. And, you know, you've got the greatest comeback story of all time, so I would do the whole book, start with Sunset Boulevard and do the whole book as a flashback. At which point she said, that was not the greatest moment in my life. And I said, what was? And she said, I was the first star ever to produce star in my own film in Europe and marry a nobleman and come back with a noble title. And it was Madame Saint-Jean in 1926 or 4, whatever it was, in France. And that's when she married the Marquis de La Falaise and came back here. And she said they gave me a whole train ride across the United States. When we got to Hollywood with Henri and I, everybody in Hollywood was at that station. And she said what nobody knew is that I'd had an abortion, you know, in France. And that's why I was very ill and why everybody wanted to see me. So I said, well, I would start the book there and do it in two flashbacks, which is what we wound up doing.
You were kind of in the position of Bill Holden with the giant manuscript of the bad Salome movie at the beginning there.
It was. It had 100 pages. It stunk. And it was obviously what they had also tried to do earlier. But once they had this flashback idea, it really worked. And so what would happen is Brian would talk to Gloria about the next year. Then he would go and work with Bill Duffy. Then Bill Duffy would come up with a rough of a chapter. And that's what they had, 100 pages, when they showed it to me. Once it started over again, we had 6 months. And so that meant a chapter a week. So Brian would come down with me with this very rough chapter by Bill Duffy, and I would completely rewrite it, throw away like 80%, call and say, look, she had an archivist, so she had saved everything. I said, I need this and this and this and this and this. And then Brian would come back a week later. I would read it to him. He would say, that's a word she would never use. And I'd say, okay, let's change it. Anyway, so it went through the whole book until she kicked Bill Duffy out about two chapters before the book was finished. So the last couple of chapters are completely mine. Okay. And Bill Duffy was out of the scene by then, and she was madly in love with Brian, this much younger guy. So yes, in fact, it was throwing out entirely their thing and completely rewriting everything he gave us.
So what were the what were her top recollections of Sunset Boulevard? I mean, was it a good experience for her? Was she resentful of the fact that people thought it was her most important thing when actually it was this other thing in the 20s?
No, she actually knew that this had been, you know, the coming back to life of Gloria Swanson. So, as she told it to me, she didn't talk about the people who had been, you know, that this had been offered to other people before Charles Brackett, the producer's office, started to call her in 1948. And so they had said, come out, we'd like you to do a screen test. And she was absolutely appalled. I mean, she said, me, a screen test? She'd been the biggest star in Hollywood, except for Mary Pickford, for 20 years. Right. But she hadn't made a movie in 10. And it had been a big bomb called Father Takes a Wife. So she knew that there was something potential there. She called George Cukor to say, they want me to take a screen test, George. What do I do? And he said, take it. He said, these are the two most talented men and popular men in Hollywood, Billy Wilder and Charles Brackett. They had made Lost Weekend, Double Indemnity. I mean, they had just a string of hits. And so she took the screen test, and then comes the long story about the casting of this movie. She was told that she would be doing the screen test with a young actor named Montgomery Clift. And when she got there, they said, Mr. Clift has another commitment. In fact, his agent had said, this would be death for you to make a movie as a gigolo with an older woman. You know, it's impossible. So what Gloria, you know, they said, but we've got another young man, not as young, William Holden. And so they said, come in and let's do a second screen test with him. And we'll make you look a little older. So they put a gray streak in her hair. Holden was 31. She was 50.
Yeah.
So we'll do it. She said, wait a minute. You're not going to make me look 10 years older. She said, all the society women in New York, all the stars that I know, when they have affairs like this, I'm the right age, 50. Not older. And she said, but I can tell you everything about makeup. We can make Mr. Holden look 10 years younger, or 5 years younger. And so they did. They cut his hair. They fixed his eyes. They did everything to make William Holden look younger. And they had nothing of a script at that point. They would come up with new pages of dialogue every day that Gloria would take. And what she had no idea was that before she had been offered this, they had first, you can imagine the kind of film that this would have been. Billy Wilder, they just had a rough idea of an old burlesque queen getting involved with a much younger man. And they originally offered this script to Mae West.
Wow.
Who was not interested. They then went to Mary Pickford, since she was married to a much younger man, and had been the biggest star along with Gloria in the 1920s in Hollywood. And Pickford read it and said, it's just not right for me, but this would be perfect for either Gloria Swanson or Pola Negri, the other great silent vamp star. So that's how Gloria got offered it. And between the time of Montgomery Clift and William Holden, she also did not know that Billy Wilder and Brackett had offered it first to Fred McMurray, then apparently to Marlon Brando. This movie could have actually wound up with Marlon Brando and Mae West wow. as a hilarious comedy. They never saw it as a dark film noir. And they even offered it, apparently, to Gene Kelly. Everybody turned it down. They thought that Brando was not a big enough star. But
really?
They finally got William Holden, and he turned out to be the perfect Joe Gillis.
Wow. And did you say, when we talked about this yesterday, that it was after Gloria Swanson came in that they built up her role? Because originally there was supposed to be a bigger part for the Nancy Olsen role?
Oh, that was supposed to be a much bigger part for the lead, the man.
Oh, okay.
Joe Gillis. And when this film opened, they had a long section of him dead in the swimming pool, his body fished out, taken to the morgue, his corpse talking, and screening audiences hated it. Huh. And that's when Billy Wilder said, "I have to change this thing completely." He cut all of that out. They got people in for like another day of shooting to shorten that opening to what it now is. And that's when they finally had a huge hit.
Wow. Well, let's talk about Eric von Stroheim, because you had some good background on that, didn't you? How did Gloria first get connected with Eric von Stroheim?
Yeah, this is Eric von Stroheim is the other key figure in this film. In 1927, when she was the queen of Hollywood, that's when she met Joe Kennedy, this renegade producer, and he took to Gloria immediately and he said, "Look, this is insane. Why are you making so much money for Adolph Zucker and Cecil B. DeMille? You should, you know, let me take over your company and you will make a fortune." And she stupidly did that. And so Joe Kennedy took over her company. And although she kept thinking the chinchilla coats and the Rolls Royces and everything were coming from him, they were actually, he was taking everything out of her own budget. He almost made Gloria broke. But what he said was, "We're going to stop making these cheap, trashy romance movies you make with DeMille. I'm going to get the classiest director from Europe here," who at that point was Eric von Stroheim, a great actor and director who made the most opulent films. You know, if somebody was said to be wearing a diamond necklace, he insisted it be diamonds. He was famous for this, for excess, luxury, and these absolutely gorgeous films. And so they brought him to America, and they started filming. He started filming Gloria in this movie that was originally to be called The Swamp. She started out as a 16-year-old convent girl and winds up as a middle-aged woman running a string of whorehouses in Africa. And they shot for days on this thing, for weeks. And they finally had hours and hours of film, but they were nowhere near the end of it. And then, as I recall, the Depression struck, but by then Gloria was just exasperated. So she wired Joe Kennedy to say, "The director is insane. What do I do?" And Joe Kennedy said, "We stop filming. Get rid of him. It's over, you know. And sound is coming in. We made the biggest mistake by making this a long, silent movie." So that was, so they parted very bitterly, Gloria and von Stroheim. Then, now it's 30 years later, and she's in Hollywood making Sunset Boulevard, and Billy Wilder has the genius idea of bringing Eric von Stroheim in and casting him as, one, her ex-husband, and two, now her butler. And when von Stroheim was offered this, he said, "Are you kidding? A butler role? Of course I'm not coming to Hollywood to do that." Then they told him it was Swanson. He came, was persuaded, and of course, he's brilliant in the film. Now, the great extension of that is that now, 30 years later, after Sunset Boulevard, von Stroheim, who still had all the cans of film from making The Swamp, contacted Gloria to say, "Gloria, with your permission, this footage is magnificent. So he said, I would like to take the early years of this just and make a short film and call it Queen Kelly, just the period when you're the convent girl and meet the handsome prince. And can I do that? And she said, yes. And so he released that, I think, in 1957. I saw it in Europe as 1958 for the first time. And he released it as Queen Kelly, which has ever since been available. And if you have not seen this thing, it's amazing. Because as the 16-year-old convent girl, Gloria was 30. And she's just, actors have raved about her in this for years. So that was the finale of all of this with Eric von Stroheim, was that he wound up actually producing part of The Swamp, which they had fallen out over after they worked together in Sunset Boulevard.
And that footage shows up in Sunset Boulevard, doesn't it? Some of it?
It does. Where she and Joe Gillis are sitting there. He said we'd watch a film every night, usually hers. And they're sitting and watching one of her old films. It's a fabulous face of her profile surrounded by candles. That is footage from Queen Kelly,
amazing.
Originally The Swamp. And that's when she stands up and says, there are no faces like that anymore. One maybe, Garbo.
All right. Uh-huh. Do any of the other hosts here have any questions for Wayne while we have him?
Is there a moment of Sunset Boulevard that strikes you as the most true to who Gloria actually was in the film?
Here we go. This is fascinating. One of the first things that Gloria would say to anybody she met was, and I hope you don't think I'm anything like that dreadful woman I play in Sunset Boulevard. Because, of course, she became tagged. Everybody thought she was a 70-year-old crazy hoot owl. And therefore, she would try to distance herself from that. She knew that the performance was great, but all the roles that she started to be offered for films were as old, eccentric, you know, outrageous movie queens and things like that. And so she tried very much to distance herself. Oh, yeah, there are lots of scenes. You know, Gloria was quite imperious. I mean, we wound up spending like a week together making all the revisions in the book that she wanted. And she'd cook dinner for us every night. The best moments, the moments when she's most like, are not those things like in the car where, you know, on her way to see DeMille, or in the stuff in the DeMille studio, when she gets very sentimental and with DeMille, who was in the movie again, who directed her in all of her great films, and Billy Wilder arranged to have them go on the set of Samson and Delilah to have DeMille himself in person there with her. But I guess to answer the question, she herself just loathed the idea of being identified in any way with Norma.
Right.
That is the myth that she, all she was doing was playing herself. She was not. And the more eccentric they realized she could be and fabulous, the more Brackett and Billy Wilder would rewrite scenes for her, and she'd memorize them overnight and then do them fresh in the morning on the set.
I've been looking through pictures from her life after Sunset Boulevard, where she'd kind of made this incredible comeback. And there's pictures of her on Johnny Carson. There's pictures of her hanging out with Liza Minnelli and Andy Warhol. It sounds like once she had this big comeback, she was kind of a big fixture of New York society until, I mean, she died in her 90s. So she had a long life after this.
Absolutely. She was 80 when we did the book. And what happened after Sunset Boulevard, Jose Ferrer was in New York on Broadway and filming Cyrano de Bergerac. And he called her to say, please do a play on Broadway with me and we'll take it on tour. And so he persuaded her to do 20th Century, that old John Barrymore, Carol Landis film again. And they did it on stage. And that restarted her career. And they were together the night of the Oscars when she didn't get it. And the great rival, Betty Davis, didn't get it. But she was with Jose Ferrer that night, and Jose Ferrer did get Best Actor for Cyrano. But that was the beginning. After that, she did several plays on Broadway, and she did do 20th Century with Jose Ferrer. And then, of course, she became the darling. Carol Burnett had her on the show. They sang together. They danced together. And of course, she was very much in demand and one of Andy Warhol's favorite people at home and in Studio 54 was Gloria, who was still with William Dufty. And so I have two pictures of them here, photographs, one of Andy's of them together. But the other actress that he absolutely loved was Paulette Goddard. But you can imagine those are the kinds of people that Andy was attracted to. But she had a definite life, and everybody was interested in her after Sunset Boulevard. They talked of making a musical of it, which of course later Andrew Lloyd Porter would make, but never with Gloria. She was much more popular. What she was very glamorous. She was this little petite lady. All the furniture in her apartment was slightly undersized. By the time I was there and spent time with her, she had kicked William Dufty out. But she was always impeccably dressed. And the night that we finished the book, she said, make us a drink. She said, I'll even have one. I'll have that green creme de menthe. And she said, would you like some ice cream? And I said, no, I'd rather have a drink. So she went, and she was gone for like an hour, and I thought, oh, my God, Gloria Swanson has died of a heart attack the night we finished her book. She later came out. She had completely put on makeup, hair beautifully done. She had this marvelous, beautiful white blouse and black slacks. And she sat down, and we had a drink. She said, there must be questions that you have, you know, after all this. Anything you want to know about Hollywood? And the fascinating one that I remember from that night is I said, because at that point, I thought the greatest genius out of Hollywood was Buster Keaton. And so I said, well, Buster Keaton is in the movie and in the card game and so on. What was he like? And Gloria's response, snobbish response, just shattered me. She said, well, we never knew him socially. You know, she said, and then she, the last line, assistant coach, she said, Chaplin was my clown.
Wow.
And I thought, Gloria, you just lost 100 points. But there we were. She later signed books for me. She came up to the publishing party and said, only you and I know who really wrote this book. And she said, and you are such a gentleman not to tell everybody.
Breaking your silence on Little Gold.
Yeah, we really got on, though. But she was not an easy lady. You know, she wanted deference to be paid all the time. One other interesting thing is, you know, in that card game where Buster Keaton is, the other old man that looks like a little old Casper Milquetoast, remember, at the card parties? That's H.B. Warner. He and Gloria had made one of her hottest movies in the 20s called Zaza. And he was also played Christ in that huge extravaganza, silent extravaganza, King of Kings. Nobody realizes that, but H.B. Warner, every one of these people, every rock you pick up, there's, you know, incredible life under it when you get to Sunset Boulevard, and mainly through the genius of Billy Wilder, who thought to bring live Cecil B. DeMille, Eric von Stroheim, and so on. I mean, it was just, once they got Gloria, they could make everything work.
That's amazing. Well, thank you, Wayne. It's really a serious privilege and pleasure to have you on the show to talk about this. Nobody knows it better. So thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Well, that does it for this week's show. Next week, we're going to be continuing our Little Gold Men Essential series. And once again, we're going to be putting it up to a vote to you guys. It'll be on our Twitter feed, a poll. We're bringing back two contenders from last week, Gangs of New York, which was the runner-up to Sunset Boulevard, and Midnight Cowboy, which I think we were all maybe the most enthusiastic about checking out, although Sunset Boulevard obviously was a great choice. And then we're adding two more into the mix, Singin' in the Rain, another classic behind-the-scenes of Hollywood movie from the 50s, and Chariots of Fire, a Best Picture winner from the 80s with a great story behind it and the kind of Oscar narratives that we get excited about. So cast your votes on Twitter and we'll be back talking about one of those next week. In the meantime, you can find us all at vanityfair.com and on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich and Mike.
Mike_Hogan.
And Richard.
Rylas. And Mike, I just wanted to say I'm so sorry to hear about your chimp.
Well, you brought the casket for the chimp funeral, right, Richard?
Yeah.
And Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description for Mike's early days working for Vanity Fair goes to Wayne Lawson.
But we never knew him socially.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
From PRX.